17. Making Mayhem. Walking up Roppongi Dori from the Anna Hotel, where she's had the cab drop her, into the shadow of the multi-tiered expressway that looks like the oldest thing in town. Tarkovsky, someone had once told her, had filmed parts of Solaris here, using the expressway as found future city. Now it's been Blade Runnered by half a century of use and pollution, edges of concrete worn porous as coral. Dusk comes early under here, and she spies signs of homeless encampment, plastic-wrapped blankets tucked back into an uncharacteristically littered scrim of struggling municipal shrubs. Vehicles blast past overhead, a constant drumming of displaced air, particulates sifting invisibly. Roppongi, she remembers, is not so nice a place, one of those interzones, a border town of sorts, epicenter of the bubble's cross-cultural sex trade. She'd gone here with crowds to bars that were hot then, but now likely weren't, but always there'd been an edge of some meanness she hadn't noticed elsewhere in town. She pauses, aware of the plastic handle of the parko bag. It's been rubbing against her palm for hours. It feels wrong for a meeting. Nothing in it but third-best skirt, tights, shrunken black fruit. She slides it between two ragged bushes bonsai by the expressway's shadow, leaving it there, and walks on. Out of the shadow and up the hill into actual evening in Roppongi proper. Checking the napkin map copied earlier from laptop screen. Parkaboy had forwarded Taki's segment of a Tokyo map. X marks the spot. One of the little streets behind the main drag. She remembers these as being either glossy or shabby, depending on the business done there. Shabby, it turns out, after a 20-minute wander, orienting to the napkin, and at one point spotting Henry Africa's in the distance, that expat bar she remembers, though that's not where she's heading. Where she's heading, she now sees, scoping it sideways as she reconnoiters past, is one of those apparently nameless little Red Lantern pub analogs they have here, places where tourists generally don't drink. Set into ground-floor walls in back lanes like this one. Their bare-bones decor, or lack of it, reminding her of a certain kind of functionally alcoholic corner lounge in Lower Manhattan, now nearing extinction as the city's ley lines shifted further still, initially in response to a decade's Disneyfication, and now to a deeper whammy. She glimpses past a dingy Norin in an open doorway, empty chrome stools of the soda fountain spin-around kind, but very low, fronting an equally low bar. Their red upholstery split and bulging, patched like her jacket, with peeling tape. She sighs, squares her shoulders, turns around, and ducks past the Norin into an ancient, complexly layered and somehow not unpleasant odor of fried sardines, beer, and cigarettes. No trouble recognizing Taki. He's the sole customer, rising and bowing, tomato-faced with reflexive embarrassment, to greet her. "You must be Taki. I'm Case Pollard, Keiko's friend from California." He blinks earnestly through dandruff-dusted lenses and bobs there, uncertain whether he should resume his seat. She pulls out the chair opposite him, removes her bag and the Rixons, hangs them across the back, and seats herself. Taki sits down. He has an open bottle of beer in front of him. He blinks, saying nothing. She'd gone back and looked at Parkaboy's initial explanation of Taki again, after she'd sketched the map on a napkin. Taki, as he prefers we call him, claims to orbit a certain otaku coven in Tokyo, a group that knows itself as mystic, though its members never refer to it that way in public, nor indeed refer to it at all. It is these mystic wonks, according to Taki, who have cracked the watermark on number 78. This segment, according to Taki, is marked with a number of some kind, which he claims to have seen and know. What she's confronted with here, she decides, is an extreme example of Japanese geek culture. Taki is probably the kind of guy who knows everything there is to know about one particular Soviet military vehicle, or whose apartment is lined with unopened plastic models. He seems to be breathing through his mouth. Catching the eye of the barman, she points to a poster advertising Asahi Light and nods. "Keiko's told me a lot about you," she says, trying to get into character. This only seems to make him more uncomfortable. "But I don't think she's told me what it is that you do." Taki says nothing. Parkaboy's faith that Taki has enough English to handle the transaction may be unfounded. And here she is, halfway around the world, trying to swap a piece of custom-made pornography for a number that might mean nothing at all. He sits there, mouth-breathing, and Case is wishing she were anywhere else, anywhere at all. He's in his mid-20s, she guesses, and slightly overweight. He has a short, nondescript haircut that manages to stick up at several odd angles. Cheap-looking black-framed glasses. His blue button-down shirt and colorless checked sport coat look as though they've been laundered but never ironed. He isn't, as Parkaboy has indicated, the best-looking guy she's recently had a drink with, though that, come to think of it, would be Big End, she winces.
I do? Responding perhaps to the wince.
Your job? The barman places her beer on the table.
Game, Taki manages. I design game for mobile phone.
She smiles, she hopes encouragingly, and sips her Asahi Light. She's feeling more guilty by the minute. Taki, she hasn't gotten his last name and probably never will, has big dark semicircles of anxiety sweat under the arms of his button-down shirt. His lips are wet and probably tend to spray slightly when he speaks. If he were any more agonized to be here, he'd probably just curl up and die. She wishes she hadn't had all this fabulous fanny stuff done and bought these clothes. It hadn't been for him, but really she hadn't imagined she'd be dealing with anyone with this evident a social deficit. Maybe if she were looking plainer, he wouldn't be as spooked. Or maybe he would.
That's interesting, she lies. Keiko told me you know a lot about computers and things.
Now it's his turn to wince as if struck and knocks back the remainder of his beer.
Things? Keiko says.
Yes. Do you know the footage?
Web movie.
He looks even more desperate now, the heavy glasses lubricated with perspiration sliding inexorably down his nose. She resists an urge to reach over and push them back up.
You know Keiko?
He winces again, getting it out. She feels like applauding. Yes, she's wonderful. She asked me to bring you something. She's suddenly experiencing full-on London-Tokyo soul displacement, less a wave than the implosion of an entire universe. She imagines climbing over the bar, past the barman with his pockmarked, oddly convex face, and down behind it, where she might curl up behind a scrim of bottles and attain a state of absolute stasis, for weeks perhaps. Taki fumbles in his sport coat's side pocket, coming up with a crumpled pack of casters, offers her one.
No, thank you.
Keiko sen?
He puts a caster between his lips and leaves it there, unlit.
A photograph.
She's glad she can't see her own smile. It must be ghastly.
Give me Keiko photo.
The caster, having been plucked from his mouth for this, is returned. It trembles.
Taki, Keiko tells me that you've discovered something, a number, hidden in the footage. Is this true?
His eyes narrow, not a wince, but suspicion, or so she reads it.
You are footage lady?
Yes.
Keiko like footage?
Now she's into improv, as she can't remember what Parkaboy and Musashi have been telling him.
Keiko is very kind to me. She likes to help me with my hobby.
You like Keiko very much?
Yes, nodding and smiling.
You like Anne of Green Gable?
Case starts to open her mouth, but nothing comes out.
My sister like Anne of Green Gable, but Keiko does not know Anne of Green Gable.
The caster is dead still now, and the eyes behind the dandruff-flecked lenses seem calculating. Have Parkaboy and Musashi blown it somehow in their attempt to generate a believable Japanese girl persona? If Keiko were real, would she necessarily have to like Anne of Green Gables? And anything Case might ever have known about the Anne of Green Gables cult in Japan has just gone up in a puff of synaptic mist. Then Taki smiles for the first time and removes the caster.
Keiko modern girl, he nods. Body con.
Yes, very, very modern. Bodycon, she knows, means body conscious, Japanese for buff. The caster, its tan faux cork filter glittering wetly, goes back between his lips. He roots through his pockets in turn, produces a Hello Kitty lighter, and lights his cigarette. Not a plastic disposable, but a chromed Zippo, or clone thereof.
Case feels as though the lighter has followed her here from Kittyland, a spy for the Hello Kitty group mind. She smells benzene. He puts it away.
Number very hard.
Keiko told me that you were very clever to find the number. He nods, seems pleased, perhaps. Smokes. Taps ash into an Asahi ashtray. There's a small, cheap-looking television behind the bar, just at the periphery of Case's vision. It's made of transparent plastic and shaped something like a football helmet. On its 6-inch screen, she sees a screaming human face attempting to thrust itself through a sheet of very thin latex, then a quick clip of the South Tower collapsing, then 4 green melons, perfectly round, rolling along on a flat white surface.
Keiko told me that you would give me the number, forcing the smile again. Keiko says you are very kind.
Taki's face darkens. She hopes it's a deeper level of embarrassment kicking in, or something to do with that specific alcohol processing enzyme the Japanese lack, and not anger. He suddenly whips a palm from his inside jacket pocket and pokes its infrared slit at her. He wants to beam her the number.
I don't have one, she tells him.
He frowns, fumbles out a fat, retro-looking pen. She's ready for this, slipping him the napkin she'd drawn her Roppongi map on. He frowns, scrolls on his palm, then copies a number on the edge of the folded napkin. She watches as he copies 3 groups of 4 numbers each, the pen's felt tip blurring in the coarse weave of the paper. Upside down, 83046805-2235, like a FedEx waybill number. She takes it as he closes his pen. She quickly reaches down into the luggage label bag, which she surreptitiously unzipped against just this eventuality, and comes up with the envelope containing the Judy image.
She wants you to have this, she tells him.
She's afraid he'll tear it as he fumbles the envelope open. His hands are trembling. But then he gets it out, has a look, and she sees his eyes are wet with tears. She can't handle this at all.
Excuse me, Taki, gesturing in what she hopes will be the direction of the toilet. I'll be right back.
She leaves her Rixons and the laptop bag hanging on her chair and gets up. She still has the napkin in her hand. Sign language with the barman gets her down a tiny hallway and into the least salubrious Japanese toilet she's seen in a while, one of those concrete hole-in-the-floor jobs from the old days. It reeks of disinfectant, and she supposes urine, but it has a door she can get between herself and Taki. She takes a deep breath, regrets it, and looks at the number on the napkin. The ink is spreading into the weave, and there's a chance it will soon be illegible. But then she sees a blue plastic pen left atop some kind of wall-mounted hand dryer. When she picks it up, it leaves a shiny chrome print in a layer of gritty dust. She tests it on the yellow graffiti-free wall, getting a thin line of blue. She copies the number on the palm of her left hand, puts the pen back on the dryer, wads the napkin up, and tosses it into the depression in the center of the floor. Then, since she's there, she decides to pee. It won't be the first time she's used one of these, but it could quite happily be the last. He's gone when she returns to the table, 2 crumpled pieces of paper money beside the empty beer bottle, her half-empty glass, the ashtray, and the torn envelope. She looks over at the barman, who scarcely seems to register her presence at all. On the red television, insectoid superheroes on streamlined motorcycles buzz through a cartoon cityscape. He took a duck in the face, she says to the barman, shrugging into the Rixons and slipping the luggage label over her head. The barman glumly nods. Outside, there is no sign of Taki, though she hasn't really expected any. She looks both ways, wondering where she might more easily hail a cab back to the Hyatt.
Do you know this bar?
Looking up into a smooth, tanned, evidently European face that she somehow doesn't like at all, she takes in the rest of him, a Prada clone, black leather and shiny nylon, shoes with those toes she hates. Hands grab her from behind hard just above the elbows, pinning her arms at her sides. There's something that's supposed to happen now, she thinks. Something that's supposed to happen. When she'd first moved to New York, her father had insisted that she take lessons in self-defense from a small, fastidious, slightly portly Scotsman called Bunny. K.
case had argued that New York was no longer as dangerous as Wynne remembered it, which was true, but it had been easier to visit Bunny 6 times than to argue with Wynne. Bunny, her father had told her, had been an SAS man, but when she'd asked Bunny about this, he'd said that he had always been too fat for the SAS, and had in fact been a medic. Bunny favored cardigans and Tattersall shirts, was very nearly her father's age, and told her that he would teach her how hard men fought in pubs. She nodded gravely, thinking that if she were ever set upon by literary types in the White Horse, she would at least be able to hold her own. So while some of her friends explored Thai kickboxing, she'd been schooled in no more than half a dozen moves most often practiced in the maximum security wings of British prisons. Bunny's preferred term for this was making mayhem, which he always pronounced with a certain satisfaction, raising his pale, sandy eyebrows. And in the way of things, Case had never, that she knew of, come even remotely close to requiring Bunny's mayhem in Manhattan. With the Prada clone's fingers scrabbling to undo the Velcro fastening between her breasts, trying to free her bag, it comes to her that what's supposed to happen now in the Bunny plan of things is this. She shoves her arms suddenly forward, just far enough to grab the glove-thin leather of both his lapels. And as the second assailant inadvertently cooperates, yanking her arms back, her hands buried in Prada's lapels, she pulls with all her might and smashes her forehead as hard as she can into Prada's nose. Never having actually followed through on this move before, Bunny not having had a nose to spare, she's unprepared both for the pain it causes her and the extraordinarily intimate sound of cartilage being crushed against her forehead. His dead weight, as he abruptly collapses, pulls his lapels from her hands, reminding her to step back, off-balancing whoever's behind her, look down between her legs, a man's shoe, black with that same horrible squared-off toe, and stamp as hard as she can, with her heel, on the revealed instep, producing a remarkably shrill scream from very close behind her left ear. Pull loose and run. And run was invariably the footnote to any Bunny lesson. She tries to, the laptop banging painfully against her hip as she bolts for the end of this alley and the lights of a brighter Roppongi, which is instantly blocked with the squeal of brakes by a silver scooter and its silver-helmeted rider, who flips up his mirrored visor. It's Boon Chu. She seems to inhabit some fluid crystalline medium, pure adrenal dream. Boon Chu's mouth is open, moving, but she can't hear him. Hitching up her skirt, all in the logic of dream, she straddles the scooter behind him and sees his hand do something that throws them forward, yanking the two black-clad men suddenly out of frame and leaving her with a sculpturally confused image of the one trying to hop one-legged as he tries to pull the other, the one she's headbutted, to his feet. In front of her, the RAF roundel on the back of Boon Chu's parka as she grabs him around the waist to keep from being thrown off, realizing simultaneously that it had been him she had seen from the Starbucks clone earlier, and him in Kabukicho the night before, and now very fast between two lines of cars waiting at the intersection, their polished doors gleaming like jellyfish in a neon sea. Out into the crossing before the lights can change, a left that reminds her she has to lean with him when he turns and that she's never liked motorcycles, and then he's bombing down a more upscale alley, past she sees something called Sugar Heel Bondage Bar. He passes her back a metallic blue helmet with flaming eyes painted on it. She manages to fumble this on, but can't fasten the strap one-handed. It smells of cigarettes. Her forehead throbs. Slowing slightly, he turns left into another alley, this one too narrow to admit cars. It's one of those Tokyo residential corridors lined with what she assumes are tiny houses and punctuated with glowing clusters of vending machines. Billy Pryan's paralyzed grin on one, proffering a bottle of pickle. She's never seen a scooter drive this fast down one of these and wonders if it's illegal. He stops where the alley intersects a wider, car-capable one, slams down the kickstand and swings off, removing his helmet. A pair of tough-eyed Japanese kids throw down cigarettes as he hands one of them his helmet and unzips his parka. "What are you doing here?" Case asks him, sounding as if nothing very remarkable has happened as she dismounts and tugs her skirt down. Boone removes her helmet and hands it to the second kid.
"Give him your jacket."
Case looks down at the Ricksons, sees the tape peeling where Dorothea burned it, She pulls the Rixons off and hands it to the boy, now fastening the strap of the blue helmet, noticing a missing finger joint there against a flaming eye decal. The boy puts the Rixons on, zips it up, and hops on the scooter behind his partner, who's wearing Boone's helmet and parka. This one snaps the mirrored visor down, returns Boone's thumbs up, and then they are gone.
"You've got blood on your forehead," Boone tells her.
"It's not mine," she says, touching it, feeling stickiness smear beneath her fingertips. Then, "I think I'm concussed. I might throw up. Or faint."
"It's okay. I'm here."
"Where did they go with the bike?" The metal column of a traffic light across the alley, furred with weird municipal techno kipple, twins itself, dances, then comes together again.
"Back to see where those two are."
"They look like us."
"That's the idea."
"What if those men catch them?"
"The idea was that they might wish they hadn't, but after what you did to them, they might not be up to much."
"Boone?"
"Yes?"
"What are you doing here?"
"Watching them watch you."
"Who are they?"
"I don't know yet. I think they're Italian. Did you get the number? Is it in the laptop?"
She doesn't answer.